Today on the show, Daniel Larrison and Jason Leopold. 3 to 5 Eastern Time. All right. Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I am writing up a blog entry about my show today right now. As you can probably tell, perhaps. A little bit of typing, some copy-pasting. I think it's all right that I haven't read Jason Leopold's article yet. I just like the title. What I should have done was I should have read it at the top of the hour during the FSN radio news with Rebecca Foster. Is that the most ridiculous top of the hour news you've ever heard? Is that not the exact same top of the hour news as yesterday? What are they doing over there? Is that an actual news network? Who's producing that thing? You should see the files when I get them. And I complained in a real rude way, but it still didn't work. The discrepancy between their highs and their lows, it's incredible. It's preposterous. And then they do stuff like send out news from last year or from yesterday. At least that was on April Fool's Day. Oh, well. So this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I come on every weekday at 3:06, right after Rebecca Foster and the FSN failure news rerun from yesterday. Yeah, welcome to my show. Today on the show, Daniel Larrison and Jason Leopold. Now, Daniel Larrison, he's a writer over there at what's called the American Conservative Magazine. And Jason Leopold, why, he writes for Al Jazeera, America.aljazeera.com. And so that's pretty good. I like those guys, man. Well, they got different specialities. Daniel Larrison, he's going to be on to talk about the American Empire in Eastern Europe. And what in the hell is the point of that anyway? I should take notes while I read all the great stuff that I read. Because, not just the stuff I'm going to interview people about. Because so many people bring up so many great points about this Ukraine stuff. I wish I could really figure out a way to, plagiarize them all in a brand new order of argument and make it my own in a way, you know, I don't know. But Daniel Larrison, he's one of the good ones, that's for sure. So we'll be talking with him. And then let me do my math right here, because it'll be, when it's 4:30 there, it'll be 3:30 here, and then it'll be 2:30 there. So. Oh, yeah, so wait, note. Yeah, it'll be great. Jason Leopold's going to be on the show. And then, yeah. I'm going to interview him. Yeah. I'm still trying to do time zones over here. Wait a minute. Okay, good. I'm going to interview him all about secret torture prisons in Eastern Europe. It's going to be really exciting. And I'm going to read his article during the next top of the hour news. Because I don't want to listen to it. I hope that when you guys turn it down during the ridiculous and pointless top of the hour news about some murder trial in a foreign country, rerun from yesterday at the top of the next hour, I hope that you'll remember to turn the volume back up again after 6 minutes of mute. Sometimes you forget, right? You mute something. I can't stand this. And you mute it, and then you forget to unmute it. Happens to the best of them, anyway. Oh, what a crappy show so far. I'm Scott, this is my show. Coming up on the show, interviews and complaints. First of all, good news. How about that? Let's start the show with good news today, folks. Pentagon to remove 50 nuclear missiles from silos. That's potentially hundreds of thousands of, maybe millions of lives saved right there. Think about that. There's hardly anything that anyone could do for anyone greater than that. Right? And you can scrape up a dying person out of the freezing gutter and save their life, but man, that's not quite as nice as removing 50 nuclear missiles from their silos. I'm not knocking saving people who are freezing. I'm promoting the abolition of nuclear weapons. And you know what? I get the idea. I'm not sure exactly how this works. But I do get the idea that most people are under the impression that only hippies are against nuclear weapons. Is that a thing that people think? That you have to be a hippie to be against nuclear weapons? Nuclear weapons. Do you know the difference? Do I know how to say the word difference? Not too well, not all the time, no. But do you know the difference between an A-bomb and an H-bomb? It's really important. It's not just trivia. An A-bomb, well, that's when you split some uranium-235 or some plutonium-239 atoms in half and release all them neutrons, and then they go releasing all their neutrons at all the other atoms, and then they all split apart, and then you get nuclear fission. Hot as the sun. It'll kill Japanese. Bam, like that. Hundreds of thousands of them. Thousands of them turn to dust. Literally, there's silhouettes etched into the concrete. But an H-bomb is when you, first of all, set off a Nagasaki-type bomb to get it hot as the sun. Now that it's as hot as the sun, now you can fuse hydrogen atoms together. And when you fuse hydrogen atoms together, well, you could kill Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Tokyo, and a bunch more. I mean, assuming they were all grouped together in one shot. You could kill Houston with an H-bomb. The Hiroshima bomb was 10 kilotons. Killed 300,000 people. The Nagasaki bomb was bigger, but it was a smaller city, and it was in a mountainous area, so it wasn't quite as effective as far as slaughtering civilians. I think it killed a few individuals less. But the bomb was bigger. The bomb, I think, was, what, 20 kilotons or maybe 30 or something? But, and that would be thousands of tons of TNT equivalent is the measurement there. But then the H-bombs, those go up into the tens of megatons. Those are the ones that when you see the pictures of them on TV, it's at least at first is this giant kind of dome of superheated plasma that kind of radiates out in all directions, and then the mushroom cloud is kind of left behind sort of thing. A lot bigger. If you've never been to Houston, it's the fifth biggest city in the world. Geographically speaking, it may be the biggest as far as circumference and all of that. There's some empty space in there, don't get me wrong, but still. Not the most crowded, but still huge. Unbelievable, but yeah. An H-bomb could kill all of Houston. And anyway, so the point is that our government and the Russian government especially hold thousands of these things. I think America still owns 6,000-something H-bombs. And the Russians, like 5,000, and that's with about, 1,500 or 2,000 at the ready each, something like that. The Americans still have more at the ready and more overall than the Russians. But still, they own enough to kill everybody, too. And then there's the British and the French and the Chinese, the Israelis, the Indians, and the Pakistanis are the rest of the nuclear weapons states. And you know what? We've gotten away with it so far, other than the Japanese at the end of World War II. But we've gotten away with avoiding a real nuclear catastrophe. But even the possibility, even the idea that we would have as current and indefinite government policy that they're just going to hold on to, that we're going to let them just hold on to thousands of hydrogen bombs, is just madness. They're holding all of humanity hostage with these things. It's completely unnecessary. And so, you know, and that ought to be for no matter what political persuasion you are. Even if you're a hardcore militarist, you're a sissy if you need H-bombs. How about that? You don't need H-bombs. Come on. Pentagon to remove 50 nuclear missiles from silos per a treaty with the Russians. And that's a good start. I say we keep going until we're done. You know, like Superman. He was no commie. He was a right-winger. Got rid of the nukes. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, we could sit here jamming out all afternoon, right? We can't. We got to move on. Yeah, a little Richard Cheese for you. All right, so which horrifying American policy should we cover first on the show today here? John Kerry, U.S. military clash on approach to Syria's rebels. Pentagon opposes direct military intervention against Assad, according to the Wall Street Journal. This is from April the 7th. Frustrated by the stalemate in Syria, Secretary of State John Kerry has been pushing for the U.S. military to be more aggressive in supporting the country's rebel forces. Opposition has come from the institution that would spearhead any such effort, the Pentagon. Mr. Kerry, I didn't read that well at all. It's because I wasn't paying attention to what I was reading. Kerry wants to bomb him. Opposition has come from the Pentagon. Mr. Kerry and the United Nations Ambassador Samantha Power have advocated options that range from an American military intervention to weaken the regime of President Bashar al-Assad to using U.S. Special Operations Forces to train and equip a large number of rebel fighters. Such moves would go far beyond the U.S.'s current engagement. In recent White House meetings, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Martin Dempsey and Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel have pushed back against military intervention, said senior officials. They say the risk is high of being dragged into an open-ended foreign entanglement. Both sides have agreed on the need to create an expanded program to train and equip moderate Syrian rebels, but the Pentagon worries the Assad regime would halt cooperation on the removal of chemical weapons if the military training starts now. So anyway, it goes on like this. I'm sorry to make the same joke over and over again. I know it really ain't funny, but ain't it kind of funny how the Founding Fathers' entire thing was how afraid they were of permanent standing armies and all the troubles that they could get nations into? And yet, more and more in our country, it's the military that's restraining the civilians who would throw them at every problem they could possibly think of in the world. And, well, it's really unfortunate because, you know, like the polls say, the Pentagon is the only institution that the American people trust, which is absolutely ridiculous. Are you kidding me? But yeah, they got the best PR, I guess. All that valor and everything. Honor and shiny swords and crap. But so that means, I don't know, when they're done completely and totally destroying the American economy, that's all we'll have left. That'll be the last institution the American people turn to make everything right. But anyway, I guess it's still better than massacring everybody else off the face of the earth, you know, which they tend to do otherwise if you let them. But anyway, yeah, that John Kerry too. I don't know. Wouldn't it be funny if anyone in TV news would point out that those urging intervention, even for the moderate rebels in Syria, are actually just fighting for Al-Qaeda against the guy who's trying to stop them. How come no one calls them out for this? It's not even funny or ridiculous anymore because we're years into this now. Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The guys we fight in Iraq. Still to this day, we, the U.S. government, backs Maliki and his war against these guys in Iraq. Still to this day, they set off suicide bombings in Iraq. But we back them on the other side of the line. The line that they've erased. And they say they don't fight them. No, we're not back them. No, we're not backing the jihadists. We're trying to back the moderates. If only Obama would let us back the moderates well enough. But there are no moderates. It's the same damn thing for years in a row now. There's no moderates. So when the Saudis and the Qataris and the Americans and the Turks are all, and the Jordanians are all working together on this project to arm these guys up, what happens? Jihadis with TOW missiles. Syrian rebels have U.S.-made anti-tank missiles. Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. U.S. military intervention in the Syrian civil war has mostly taken the form of small arms and equipment for various rebel factions, but looks to be picking up the pace dramatically as new videos come out showing U.S.-made BGM-71 TOW anti-tank missiles in rebel hands. Two different rebel factions, the Free Syrian Army, I thought they were gone. Didn't they hightail it across the border? They come back? I mean, into Turkey. There's still a border there. I guess they're back. And a faction allied with the so-called Islamic Front are claiming to have the weapons, though the U.S. is not officially confirming they were the direct suppliers. And, of course, this is a big part of Seymour Hersh's article, is that part of the reason he says that Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey did the false flag sarin attack in Syria was because it was a last-ditch effort to get the Americans to intervene decisively on the side of the rebels who he's thrown his lot in with and who he doesn't want to be stuck with after their loss. And so, and they're losing. And I guess he believed, or so the reporting goes, that at least they had a chance at it when America was sponsoring the arms pipeline from Libya to Syria. And you know what? It was so obvious back at the time, and again, it's in the Telegraph and the Sunday Times and everything else about America's role in that. And that, you know, when they were saying, yeah, we're hunting for the surface-to-air missiles, they were making it pretty obvious, weren't they, that that was only a small part of the story. They were turning over everything they could to the jihadis, and they were sending jihadis, too, by the hundreds, to go and fight in Syria. But we don't want them to have reliable surface-to-air missiles. RPGs is one thing, but a reliable Stinger or Stinger substitute that can take out a jetliner? That's bad politics. And so they're worried about that. But then, you know, Fox News has been covering it since it was on the Democrats' watch. They would call it treason if it was the other way around, but that's all right. Because it's not treason, it's just journalism, that this was going on. That's a big part of what, maybe that's exactly, as Hersh reports, that's what Ambassador Stevens was doing in Benghazi. That's what the so-called consulate was for, was arranging, and the CIA mission there, arranging the shipping of arms and men to go fight in Libya. But then, you know, these guys have been our enemies, so how they convince themselves that it would be all right to station their ambassador in the center of a hornet's nest. I mean, I admit they had just finished fighting a war for these jihadists at the time. But still, does that necessarily have to translate into trust them? I don't know. I guess that's why I'm not a Democrat, right? My foreign policy could not possibly suck this bad, no matter what. All right, well, so, and then, by the way, speaking of the war in Iraq that is still going on, and as Patrick Coburn's been saying all along, has been re-energized by the American and Saudi and Turkish and Jordanian and Qatari backed war in Syria. This one is from Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Iraq to exclude major Sunni cities from vote, citing Al-Qaeda. voting impossible because of ongoing military violence. So, you know, in 2005, this is what caused the civil war, was the Shiites won outright. The Sunnis boycotted it. They were going to lose anyway, but it was a proportional representation kind of thing, religious slates. It was really, you could blame the Americans for invading and occupying the place, and that was a big part of it, and the reason that a negotiated peace did not take place was because the Americans were there to be used by the Shiite parties. But it was really the Ayatollah Sistani. It was, you know, the American wish. They wanted to, first they wanted a Hashemite king like in Jordan, a very loyal, ridiculous sock puppet like it was the 50s still kind of a thing. And then they said, well, no, we'll call it democracy, but we'll have this caucus system, and we'll try to put Chalabi in charge there. But then, no, that didn't work out. I think Bush turned against Chalabi before the CIA and the State Department did, actually, or right around the same time. And then, well, no, I guess after, but soon after the invasion. And so that didn't work, and then they didn't know what the hell they were going to do. I guess they tried to do this caucus system, but then the Ayatollah Sistani said, nope, one man, one vote. And then after that, it was on. Majority rules. There's your democracy. Majority rules. Shiites win the elections. Shiites take Baghdad. Can't cut and run now. Gotta help them do it. And so a million people died. That's the war that happened there. I'm getting better at summing that up. But so now, rewind only back to 2009 and the elections of that spring where Alawi won. But Maliki put together the coalition, stayed in power anyway because of the way the parliamentary system works there for the votes. And it was undecided for a long time, and then he squeaked it out. But now it looks like even if the Sunnis wanted to participate in these elections, the Anbar province, they're just not even going to hold elections there. I guess that means in Fallujah and Mosul and Ramadi. And so, that's just going to make things that much worse. There's your democracy. Hope you liked it. A million people killed. For nothing. For not a thing. Well, for not a thing that any American values. Muqtada al-Sadr likes it better than it used to be. These are the guys. Remember that story from the Christian Science Monitor in 2005? To them, a woman's smile is a crime. The Shiite militias going around cutting barbers' throats, running all the liquor stores out of town, and instituting Taliban-type rule, even though under Shiites, for the women of southern Iraq. Been a while since anybody knows that, huh? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right. Do the show, Scott. Do the show. Okay, I'm going to talk about stuff now. Man, I got a bunch of stuff to cover here. Let's talk about Matthew Akins and Anand Gopal in Harper's. Both of these guys, friends of the show, especially Anand. I've spoken with him many times. In fact, man, you want to hear some stuff, go back and listen to some of my interviews of Anand Gopal about Afghanistan. Matthew Akins, I've interviewed one time, and he did a story about the kill team, or was it, no, not the kill team, the A team, kill squad, or, I get my war criminals in Afghanistan confused sometimes, I'm sorry, I haven't had enough coffee today.
One large just didn't cut it. Which death squad am I trying to think of here now? It was one of the death squads in Afghanistan that Akins wrote about that I interviewed him last fall. And anyway, so now here these two guys have an article that they've written together. Matthew Akins and Anand Gopal at harpers.org/blog. The Ghost Polls of Afghanistan. Aw, man. And what's it about? It's about how there's no election day in the countryside. There's no security in Afghanistan. There's no state in Afghanistan even capable of holding an election for itself in 2014. Yeah. Well, you know, everybody who wasn't lying to you has been telling you all along that this excuse, at least, is a fool's errand. The staying in Afghanistan until it is a functioning democracy. Give us a break. As, Eric Margulies on the show said, they've had their loyajurgas and their ways, their laws and their customs and their fights and their ways of working things out between themselves that has never required American help for eons. Leave them alone. And in this election, there's no representation for the Taliban. And the Taliban are, again, pretty much the only representation that the Pashtuns have. I mean, Hamid Karzai, he's a Pashtun, but he's kind of like a, is it Upper East Side or Upper West Side that is the fancier one? He's from that part of Kabul. He's not part of the Pashtun tribal network, not really, or his part of it is some small part with no influence. And, you know, I don't know, Ann Jones was saying on the show, there's a lot of Taliban already in the government as it is, so who's to negotiate with? I mean, they've already won. What are you talking about? So, you know, I guess it all just depends on who you define as Taliban. It's not people who call themselves Taliban, right? It's not people who've sworn loyalty to Mullah Omar. It's people who resist the Americans. People who resist the sock puppet government we've created there. And by the way, all reporting is unanimous that their army and their police force is a joke. It's a joke. Doesn't exist other than the Americans sitting there babysitting them all damn day. And everybody knows it. And everybody's known the whole time. And how come nobody has to be in trouble? Everybody complains about Iraq all the time. But how come nobody has to be in trouble for the surge being a gigantic failure in Afghanistan? Tens of thousands of people blown up to death, man, for nothing. They blew them up to death. I'm sorry, stupid to say it that way, but come on. It's, you know, 1,000 people killed is just a number. It's just a sound. But like, no, really, they horribly have slaughtered just in the worst imaginable, nightmarish kind of ways that, you know, imagine, seriously, people breaking into your house in the middle of the night, like your local sheriff's department SWAT team times 10,000, or even times 10, you know? The Delta Force or the Navy SEALs coming in your house and killing you in the middle of the night, killing your family, killing the neighbors for coming outside to see what's going on, blasting the whole place. Madness they did over there. And, you know, if you go back and listen to my interviews with Michael Hastings from the time, I never did finish his damn book and interview him about the book, but I interviewed him about his journalism from Afghanistan during the surge, not just about getting Hastings in trouble, McChrystal in trouble, but about the actual surge itself, and the whole theory of the surge. U.S. Army to stand around like a bunch of traffic cops helping people while the Delta Force and the rest of the Joint Special Operations Command are going around doing their Gestapo night raids. Oh, highly targeted. Yeah, that never worked. It was never going to work. They're always using it as an excuse. A counterinsurgency campaign in Malaya back in, what, the 1960s or something, where it was a very small minority Maoist group that was rising up against the majority, and the majority had the upper hand in every way, including being backed by the British and what have you. And so your one successful counterinsurgency ever is not applicable to any other situation, really, at all. The whole thing is just an excuse. As we talked about at the time with Gareth Porter, the whole, and just as the same thing it was with the war in Iraq, the surge is just a way to add time to the Washington clock. That's what David Petraeus called it. We want to drag this thing out longer. More. And so, more people dead, and yet no promised outcomes delivered. None of them. They can hold an election for six of their handpicked warlords. Did you hear Eric Margolies, a guy who's been covering Afghanistan for 25 years, for 30 years, on the show, saying, give me a break. This whole thing is a farce. This is ridiculous. This would be like an election between Nancy Pelosi and her six closest girlfriends in the House of Representatives. This is not anything but a sham. A sham where, you know, people are slaughtered in the name of it. But anyway, don't worry. They'll let you know what the elections are, and then we'll just all celebrate the ritual of voting itself. Look, democracy as not an end, not a means to an end, liberty, prosperity, or, you know, any other value that you might value. But no, just because we like paper and boxes. Paper and boxes are great. The results of what comes out of the paper and boxes. I saw actually where Akins and Gopal tweeted this out. And the first response was, a vote has been held. Take time to celebrate the good things and stop making accusations. And what? Come on. Really? A vote was held, great. And what did it mean? Other than more dividing lines between more warlords to kill more people. And it also, of course, is, you know, the question has been whether the new sock puppet will be as amenable as Karzai always ended up being, no matter how complainy he talked, and invite the Americans to stay. Got to get that invitation there, and I'm sure they're doing everything they can to make sure that, and you know what, I'm sure it's not going to take much either to get invited. Obama's already signed the deal to stay till 2024. Now they just need the immunity deal, so that they can stay till 2024. But the deal to stay till 2024 has already been signed. Another 10 years of occupying Afghanistan. Oh, with just a few tens of thousands of troops. Never mind whether the surge worked or not. I guess they might as well not have done that at all. Huh. They'll just leave a few tens of thousands of troops there. You know, for going on missions and for training, just like right now. Oh, well. Good luck, Afghans. Sorry, I can't do anything about ending the war against you or anything. All right. And by the way, this on an entirely different subject. Just in from the Huffington Post here. Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras both to return to the United States to receive the Polk Award this Friday in New York City. And you know, I like to think that it's probably all right, actually. First, I thought, you know what, man? You better make sure that enough other different journalists have the documents and are prepared to publish them and finish the work that you started here, or at least you got all the rest of the big bombshells in your book that's coming out or whatever before you go leaving Brazil. I guess I have to assume that he's responsible enough to have taken care of that somehow. Because there's a risk. But then again, Barton Gellman of the Washington Post, who wrote a not authorized biography, but not a scandalous unauthorized biography either, just a critical and widely accepted and proclaimed biography of Dick Cheney, the angler. Or not the angler, I guess it's just angler. But he writes for the Washington Post. You know, like Bob Woodward. So he's got to be 100% safe from publishing about these documents. Greenwald has been singled out as somehow some kind of co-conspirator and some Russian espionage or some nonsense. But not necessarily by the Justice Department, just by a lot of blowhard politicians so far. But, you know, at the same time, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, has refused to rule out. In fact, he leaked a non-denial denial of saying, you know, best as we know, under the present circumstances, according to what Jill said, or, you know, something, I think probably we would not prosecute Glenn Greenwald. Something along those lines. Very dishonest non-denial denial. So I think there really is a danger when you look at the war on whistleblowers and journalists. Look at how the AP reporter was... the AP reporters all were unindicted co-conspirators so that they could all have all their phone records seized. And then the Justice Department considered a Fox News reporter an unindicted co-conspirator so they could seize all and search all of his records and this kind of thing. But on the other hand, you know, I don't think they can take Barton Gellman to prison. And he's actually released a lot less whistleblower-y type stuff than Greenwald. Still good journalism, but it's not quite as civil libertarian as Greenwald's focus has been. So hopefully Glenn Greenwald will be protected by that. I say stay in Brazil, man. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And yeah, that guy's right. You should consider advertising on the show, your group or your business or whatever it is. We might not make a fortune, but we could work something out, I bet. Shoot me an email, scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, you like having a show to listen to, right? All right, well, I'm blackmailing you then. All right. Of course, you probably already heard because it's all over the place. More good news, I think. Stephen Colbert is inheriting the Letterman show. Oh, good. Oh, Letterman isn't dead. He's just quitting. I guess because he's old. I haven't watched in a long time. But anyway, you know, I like Letterman. But he ain't that smart. And Colbert I like, but he's smarter. And, you know, I don't really care about movie stars and all of that crap, so I don't really... Yeah, I probably won't watch the show, honestly. But I think probably it'll be good. I think, you know, obviously he'll have to drop his Fox News character, which will probably be, you know, I don't know. It gets old at some point, doesn't it? Anyway. So, but, yeah, he's a smart guy and he's a funny guy, and I think it's probably for the best. Sounds good to me. Stephen Colbert on The Letterman Show. Who even watches TV, man? I don't even watch TV. I mean, I'm watching it right now, but that's just the stupid CNN. Just in case something really big explodes really big in the middle of the show, then presumably they'll cover it. But otherwise, a little bit of Family Guy, I guess, you know. Jason Leopold coming up on the show to talk about the CIA torturing people to death in former Soviet gulags in Eastern Europe. Isn't that going to be great? Man, that's going to be great.
Also, Daniel Larrison to talk about maybe going to nuclear war with Russia over Eastern Europe. Well, we got to have somewhere to torture our somebodies.
Well, look, the CIA kidnapped this guy. What are we supposed to do? Not torture him? Come on.
So, that should be good. And you know what? I don't think there's a large risk of World War III over Ukraine. Come on. But it's possible. And it's a lot more likely than if America wasn't messing around where it doesn't belong. That's for sure. But anyway, Daniel Larrison, he's real smart. He's going to talk all about that. That's coming up on the show here in just a minute. And so, you know what? I really should interview this guy, but somebody else already did it on their show. I don't know. Or was it? Maybe it was not an interview. Maybe it's, was it an interview? Oh, no, it's just the guy wrote this, and then he did it out loud for a radio station and somewhere. So I should interview him. And what this is, it's North County Public Radio in Chateaugay, New York? Really? I don't know. Chateaugay, New York? Is that how you say it? They can name it that if they want, dude. It's cool. And anyway, the article is really interesting. And it's really kind of sad, too. Empire in decline and all of that. Here's how it goes. How America's drug war sparked the North Country prison boom. And what it's about, like a lot of things, ultimately, it's about Nelson Rockefeller. In this case, his decision to ramp up what have been called in New York ever since then, and which have been a model for the nation, the Rockefeller drug laws, under the theory that if we just severely punish people for the slightest drug offense, then that'll let them know we need mean business, and then they won't do it anymore, or I don't know what. I don't think you're supposed to ask about the second part of it. Just will be tough and great. Anyway, so what they did was they just locked people in prison for decades for ridiculous drug crimes. And, of course, that created a massive prison industrial complex up there of, you know, special interests in northern New York. Where they would house all the criminals from New York City, or the so-called criminals, the offense committers from New York City. And so then it talks about the generations of people in northern New York as all the mines closed down and the logging closed down and the mill closed down and industry closed down and capitalism closed down. Everybody left in upstate New York had one place to work. The prisons. And so they've built an entire culture of prison keepers, of prison guards. They talk about, yeah, it's a generational thing, you know, like it's a family business. A lot of people, their parents were in corrections, and now they're in corrections too, right? That's the profession, corrections, and they're in it. Not, well, see if I can get a job as a prison guard for a little while or something. But no, this is who they are. This is their slice of the American story right here for the books. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people whose only profession has ever been caging their neighbors for nothing. And then you kind of can't blame them, although, yeah, you can, but you kind of can't blame them. The guys in the picture here, they've got some protest signs made up. Stop the closures. Jobs supporting our communities. Keep these prisons open. Oh, come on now, guys. Do you really think other people should have to be locked in cages just so
that you may be the one keeping them in those cages? I'm sorry, but at some point you got to take a little bit of responsibility for the society that you live in here, you know? It's like the lady in Fahrenheit 9/11 who he interviews, where she's this nice old lady with 9 kids and 19 grandkids or whatever the hell her story is, and she's the matriarch of the clan now that Pa's dead, and she works down at the local bomb factory, and she makes these bombs. First you put this part here, and then you pour this stuff in there, and then you put this part on top and lock it in place like that, and then, you know. And she says, you know, I guess, yeah, these are, you know, going to be used at some point. They're not all training bombs, right? Some of them are going to go, but I guess I just hope they're going to protect our guys over there, which she knows she's just rationalizing now. It's acceptable in polite society, but that doesn't mean it's right to make bombs for the U.S. politicians to use to murder people with. That makes you an accessory to murder, lady, and you know it deep in your heart, but at the same time, everybody, you kind of can't blame her, right? That's the only factory in town. They make bombs for the Republicans to kill people with, and for the Democrats to kill people with. And so it's the same thing here, and it's the same thing with anything. You know, the only reason I go on and on about this kind of stuff is because I kind of would like to believe it's not so. Like, come on, man. I understand it's nice to get free money all the time and not have to have a real job or all that. I'm kind of living that life right now doing this radio show. It's great. I don't make a lot, but still. There's no union to keep me here either. I can't make you advertise on the show. I'm just asking. Still... It seems like, well, to get back to an earlier topic, hydrogen bombs, it seems like if your job is the CEO of a company that makes hydrogen bombs for the U.S. government, that you ought to be okay with the government and the society deciding that, you know what, they just don't require your services anymore. What you were doing, it was so necessary. And we thank you for your service and all that. But we're going to go ahead and move on now. That ought to be acceptable. That ought to be completely acceptable. For the Senate to ratify a START treaty with the Russians ought to be completely acceptable. And yet what happens? The lobbyists show up, just like it was for farm loans or for Social Security money or for a war for Israel or for any other subject. The special interests and their lobbyists, they show up in Washington, D.C., and they say, Senator, here's some money and a pretty girl and a steak dinner and a bottle of champagne, and we really need to sell you more H-bombs so we can make more money. And mankind be damned. It's the same thing true down to the least contract public servant. So they can be private, quote-unquote private, but if they're on a government contract, that's not private. That's just corrupt. Whatever degree of corrupt, more or less, I guess, depends whether you are left or right, but it ain't private, free market. And so what it is it's just job holderism, man. And here these guys literally have protest signs, or holding a giant rally, save our jobs, save our county. We don't have, it's North County Radio, it's North Country Public Radio. I'm sorry, I said that wrong earlier in case you're trying to Google it and didn't mean to hurt any New York Yankees feelings there either. Oh man, it's already time for the news. Damn. Anyway, prison keepers. They are just welfare whores like the rest of the Republicans. That's all I was really trying to say. All right. Now on with the terrible news. I got to read this Jason Leopold article real quick.
The military industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role, and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today is Daniel Larrison. He writes at the American Conservative magazine. That's theamericanconservative.com/Larrison. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Daniel?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
That's good. I'm very happy to have you here. I always like reading your stuff, and, well, I always like anything really sane about America's policy in Eastern Europe, and you've got that in spades here, thank goodness. So I'll ask people again to please go look at theamericanconservative.com/Larrison. I guess, first of all, the facts, can we talk about the latest developments with the cities and the unrest in Eastern Ukraine? And can I ask you what you think may come of that? And then maybe we can talk about, a lot of other aspects.
Sure. Well, so you've seen a number of demonstrations or uprisings, or at least what seem to be uprisings, in some of the cities in eastern Ukraine, particularly Donetsk, where they have declared their own self-defense forces, so-called self-defense forces, and in Donetsk, at least, they've declared a revival of an old post-revolutionary independent republic, which, of course, nobody recognizes at this point. It's basically just a few people in one building at the moment, but there's clearly unrest. There's clearly a lot of anti-government sentiment in terms of being opposed to the people who have taken over in Kiev, and there's reason to think that the Russians are stoking this and encouraging it. If only to give the people in Kiev a headache and to create a problem for them, and to create a situation where they either have to suppress these demonstrations with force, as they threaten to do, or allow the eastern half of the country to gradually drift out of their control. And then meanwhile, the Russians do have large numbers of soldiers on the border that are at least potentially there, or at least they're there to threaten the possibility of Russian intervention. But nobody, I think nobody really knows for sure one way or the other how far into Ukraine Russian forces would actually go if they were to do that, or if they would try to do it covertly as they did in Crimea. Meanwhile, the situation in Ukraine overall is not good economically. They're on the verge of default, and there doesn't seem to be anything, even economic aid from the West, that would prevent that at this point.
So they're going to be starting from the bottom up one way or the other in the entire country there. And then, I guess, you know, all the industry in the East, that was a big part of the argument over the trade agreement, right, was that the trade agreement would end the protectionism for the old industry in the East, and they'd basically be wiped out by competition with more efficient European producers and that kind of stuff. And here they're already on their last legs as it is. That was meant to, or at least in effect, it would have killed off what little economy they even had left. Is that about right? At least in the short term.
The association agreement with the EU would have made conditions very difficult for Ukrainian industry, and then the Russian response to that agreement would have compounded the problem, because most of Ukraine's markets for those goods are in Russia. So Russia has an interest in continuing that supply to them, but they were also willing to impose trade sanctions in order to penalize Ukraine for pursuing that association agreement. So if that had, in fact, gone ahead, then Ukrainian industry would be deprived of one of its largest market. So in terms of the near-term economic future of Ukraine, it looks very bad. And, of course, the Russians have just said that they're contemplating cutting off gas supplies on account of the fact that the Ukrainians have not paid their gas bills for some time and are, in fact, in no position to pay them because they owe too much money and they don't have nearly enough. So it's a number of things that are coming together at the same time that are making their economic and financial situation untenable.
Right. All right. Now, as far as the Russian soldiers on the other side of Ukraine's eastern border there, obviously a lot has been made of it from a lot of different competing sources. And numbers have gone as high as 100,000. And then other reports have seemed to say that not much has changed, really, as far as the numbers of Russian soldiers stationed near the Ukrainian border right there, whatever. Can you tell me what's the best sense you can make of what's going on there, or what kind of likelihood you think there might be that they will cross that border?
From what I've seen, the conservative estimate is that there is something on the order of 30 to 40,000 on the eastern border. And I, as far as I know, that's about as high as it goes. I think to the extent that there's any consensus about what may be about to happen is that, at least from the Russian perspective, it's much better for them to try to stir things up through the use of covert operations and then special forces and intelligence operatives to keep things churning and to keep political unrest going as long as possible to make things harder on the new government in Kiev. But I don't, and of course we may be proven wrong about this, but I don't think it makes sense for them from their own perspective to wade into what would become a guerrilla war potentially if they actually sent their regular forces in large numbers. There's no reason, they don't need to do that because they already have enough other levers to influence the situation without going that far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me if I try to put myself in Putin's position. He's gotten the Crimea thing locked down nice and easy. No point in pushing it, but then again, I guess, well, so then the question is, how far would America have to push it, or would the new junta in Kiev have to push it to provoke them into actually coming across? Because, of course, the people, some of the protesters in the East were saying, well, hey, we want a referendum. We want to vote just like the Crimeans on independence or a protectorate status with Russia, and we want Russian peacekeepers to come and protect us. And, you know, that's the kind of thing any politician loves to hear, is that his soldiers are being invited somewhere. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that could provide a pretext for coming in. But I think the only thing that would actually trigger a Russian intervention is if a large attempt to suppress these demonstrations took place. So if the Ukrainian government refrains from that kind of crackdown, which would be desirable in and of itself, it would also avoid giving the Russians that pretext to come across the border, because they will claim that now the abuses of the Russian-speaking population are taking place, and they're there to stop them. So really the key for, as far as the Ukrainian government is concerned, is not to give them that pretext. And as long as the Russians can't at least dress it up somewhat plausibly as intervening on behalf of people who are being attacked, they probably won't come across.
Mm. All right, well, so I won't waste your time with having you debunk the theory that, you know, just Putin's aggressive nationalism caused all of this. Obviously, it's a situation of blowback created by the Western powers here. But I wonder, why do they keep pushing it in Ukraine? I mean, I can see the whole rebuilding America's defenses strategy for just conquering as much of the world as you can and incorporating it as much as you can into your alliances or whatever. But at the same time, it seems like, you know, these guys all went to fancy schools and stuff. They've got to know that they can only push things so far, like a second color revolution in Kiev in 10 years, you know?
Well, you'd think that they would know that there are limits to what can be done and what Russia will put up with. But I think we've seen, in fact, that they aren't aware of that. They don't really give any credence to Russian complaints or the possibility of Russian retaliation, because as far as they're concerned, anything that Russia does to push back, they will declare illegitimate and will therefore justify even more aggressive measures from our side. So in that sense, I don't think they see a problem with what's been going on, in that it justifies the push into the former Soviet Union that so many of these people have been advocating all along. And they'll say, well, look, we're the stabilizing force, we're the benevolent force. That's how they convince themselves that what they're doing makes sense. When, indeed, looking at the results over the last 4 or 5 months, enormous instability has resulted from trying to force Ukraine to join one camp or another, which is why I think that the solution that still makes the most sense is to try to come up with some arrangement that guarantees Ukrainian neutrality and doesn't try to force it into one camp or the other, because obviously neither faction or neither side has enough support within Ukraine to make it stick.
Right. In fact, I mean, that's what the Obama administration has said they want to do, right? I mean, it's been a couple of weeks since John Kerry, at least in principle, conceded that they needed to rewrite the Constitution, work something out. And I'm sorry, I'm only just realizing we got to go out to break in 10 seconds here. Daniel, hold it right there. We'll be right back with Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative right after this, y'all. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com. All right, sorry about that, and commercial breaks. They're on a timer here. Well, it's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative magazine. And we're talking about the situation in Ukraine here. And I guess one of these headlines I X'd out this morning, I never really got a chance to read, I don't think, Daniel, but said that the Americans are saying that they don't put much hope in any upcoming talks with the Russians about what to do in Ukraine. And I guess I just wonder whether you think, I mean, because what you just said is so obviously true, right? That if you want to hold the state together, well, then, you know, embrace more federalism and then there's less to fight about, you know? That's pretty simple. It's the obvious solution. I think Kerry has more or less conceded that in one or the other of his statements anyway. So I guess, what are the odds you're placing on it? Is the momentum with a solution as obvious as this one, perhaps?
Well, I don't think so, for a couple of reasons. One, whatever hints our officials may have given that a federalized Ukraine might be a way out of this crisis, there is strong resistance in Washington and in a lot of Western capitals to the idea that great powers negotiate over how Ukraine will govern itself. It's not that they're, of course, averse to interfering in the internal affairs of other states, as we know, but in this case, they're maintaining the fiction that great powers don't engage in this sort of behavior anymore, and so it's inappropriate for this sort of deal to be struck.
Yeah, only unilaterally, right? But you don't negotiate with third parties over it. That's in bad form. I understand.
And so, I mean, there is an added obstacle that the people currently running the Ukrainian government wouldn't agree to that. They seized control of the central government. They want to keep a strong central government relative to what the federalized proposal would allow. So they're not interested in ceding power to the eastern part of Ukraine, which perversely is giving people in eastern Ukraine more of an incentive to look for outside support for their own interests.
Right.
So I don't think you can get the current government or the western part of the country to sign off on a federalized arrangement, and I don't think you're going to get a lot of western governments, at least not right now, to agree to Ukrainian neutrality. You still have a lot of people making irresponsible noises about trying to bring Ukraine into NATO, of all things. So there, if anything, the mood in Western capitals is running in the opposite direction, away from that sort of compromise, because they consider any compromise with the Russians at this point to be illegitimate or even immoral, maybe, or that's what they will say. So there's going to be enormous resistance to any sort of compromise deal that might prevent further instability and violence.
Well, so, you know, I don't know. There probably is, right? Some bureaucrat's last name has this metric named after him kind of thing. But is there a way to count just how much of a central state exists in eastern Ukraine now that this regime change has taken place? I mean, to what extent is the military and the police force and whatever other of their centralized bureaucracies, still really in operation there? Because I'm reading about, you know, uprisings of one kind or another, massive protests of one kind or another in quite a few towns there. And I just wonder, well, I'm hoping to not see anybody fight about it, but I wonder if it's the kind of thing where the people of the East, outside of governmental power, have the ability to kind of form up militias and fight. The way, in fact, we saw in the West, you know, with the neo-Nazis fighting on the streets and seizing the government buildings. I don't know how much further they could have taken it than that. But anyway, we'd all hate to see eastern Ukraine turn into the lawless Anbar province where just everybody's killing each other for a few years.
I think you're seeing a sort of start of that in terms of the formation of these, of what they're calling self-defense forces in some of these cities. How much central government control has completely broken down, I'm not sure, but you are seeing to some extent a mirror image of the seizure of regional and local government buildings that we saw in western and central Ukraine prior to the overthrow of the president. And so the central government does seem to have a limited ability to wield control over these regional centers when the people controlling that central government are deeply distrusted or even loathed, as first Yanukovych and now this group has been.
Yeah. All right. Now, so on the question of America messing around over there and wanting so badly to bring Ukraine into NATO, it would seem like this entire crisis fomented by whoever, no matter what we're talking about here, would be reason number one why not to expand, certainly not to expand NATO to include Ukraine, but it ought to also bring up major questions about just what kind of commitment we really have to the rest of the countries in Eastern Europe. You know, I keep reading people talk about, the cities, the capital cities. You know how people refer to countries by the name of the capital city, like Washington says this, Moscow replies that, or whatever. And then, but they're talking about the capitals of Latvia and Estonia and these places. I've never even heard of these cities, and yet, the Democrats and the Republicans have signed me up to trade Austin, Texas, for them if it comes down to it. And I just wonder, I mean, most people just kind of shrug that off and say, just because we put those countries in NATO doesn't mean we would really defend them. But I worry that we might actually defend them if it came down to that. What if Putin decided to call our bluff?
Well, that is one of the dangerous things about past rounds of NATO expansion, is that it went ahead without really thinking about what we would have to do if, in fact, it ever came to a point where Russia challenged that security guarantee. And so I think in that case, I mean, unfortunately, if Russia thinks that our guarantees to some of those countries, especially the Baltics, don't mean very much, then we could end up spiraling into a conflict that we certainly don't want and we don't need. It would be a disaster for everyone involved. So the worry is, because it is such a disastrous outcome for all concerned, that there would be doubt on the part of the Russians that it would actually be honored in the breach. My sense is that as long as we don't try to make commitments that go beyond the ones that we already have, as long as we limit our security guarantees to the countries that are already in NATO, then that will actually remove an incentive for the Russians to cause trouble, because one thing they simply will not allow is the further expansion of the alliance into their periphery. Mm-hmm. And indeed, we saw in 2008 that was one of the major reasons why they helped to provoke the crisis with a helping hand from Saakashvili, of course, because they very much wanted to keep Georgia out of NATO, and Saakashvili played right into that plan. And I think Georgia will never join now as a result of that. And so as long as we don't overextend our commitments and then at least honor the ones that we've already made, I think that's probably the best way to keep things from spinning out of control. Sorry if that was a bit disjointed.
No, that's right. So I guess then, would you say wait a little while and maybe then start disbanding NATO? You don't want to start disbanding NATO in response to this crisis, I think you mean, but... I mean, do we need this alliance for the long term?
I think, I mean, as a political matter right now, it will be much, much harder to make arguments for the dissolution of NATO than it would have been just a year or two ago. Because now a large number of governments that belong to NATO see the value in having it as a defensive alliance again. Now, the good news may be that because they're remembering that it was designed as a defensive alliance, it will stop NATO from getting us into or using NATO as a platform for getting involved in other wars outside of Europe. And then so that may be one good outcome out of all of this. But the danger is, I think, that we're going to see calls for more of a military buildup in Eastern Europe and more military spending and the redeployment of American forces to Europe. And I think all of those things would be mistaken and shouldn't be pursued. I think the thing to be looking at in the long term is to find a way for the U.S. to hand off defense responsibilities to the Europeans themselves and to minimize our exposure to their conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it is just politics, right? I remember Thatcher coming to the defense of NATO when France and Germany were talking about creating an EU army back in the 1990s, and she was saying, no, we have to keep it NATO, and we, you know, because obviously her interest was having the Americans and the British as the head of the alliance and keeping all of, you know, France and Germany and everybody else in line at old Europe, right? We got them surrounded. And, oh, but no, they're our allies and we love them and we cooperate with them in this great alliance that they're part of too. But it's made to constrain their choices in a lot of ways in the first place, right?
Well, and I think the bigger concern for people that want the U.S. to have an active role in NATO and to keep NATO growing is to make sure that the U.S. doesn't remove itself from European affairs as much as I think would make sense at this point. The famous saying is that it was created to keep the Germans down, the Russians out, and the Americans in. Mm-hmm. And
I didn't realize that was a famous saying. That's a good one. I'm sorry. Go ahead. What?
That's Lord Ismay. He was a Secretary General of NATO. Uh-huh. And he was saying that because there was the fear that the Americans would want to go home and leave European defense to the Europeans. And certainly at this point, that makes far more sense than continuing to maintain the fiction or the idea that the U.S. is a European power, as many of our politicians will often say.
Right. I mean, and in fact, none of the European powers or the American power, for that matter, need all this military anyway. None of us face any actual threats to our own countries at this point, so the whole thing is kind of moot if you look at it that way, it seems like to me. But all right. Well, I'm sorry. We're out of time. Thanks very much for your time, Daniel.
Oh, thanks, Scott.
All right, but that's Daniel Larrison. Oops. TheAmericanConservative.com/Larrison. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X Key Score, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something, something important, something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, everybody, let's talk about the CIA torturing people to death. Next up on the show is Jason Leopold from America.AlJazeera.com. Revealed. Senate report contains a new... Oops, not A. Revealed. Senate report contains new details on CIA black sites. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
Doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, good. I'm very happy to have you here. And, glad to see you doing what you do. Good journalism here. Tell us more about the black sites. I see that the former Nazi, then Soviet, then CIA, then revealed by my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, torture prison in Poland is part of your story here. What can you tell us about that?
Sure.
What more can you tell us?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I just want to make it clear that a number of these assertions, claims that, you know, that have been leveled about what is going to wind up in that Senate report, that five-year study that they did on the CIA's rendition, detention, and interrogation program, that for people who have been following this, who have been watching it closely, this is not any new news, but it does mean it's the first official sort of confirmation that, for example, the CIA had a black site at Guantanamo, that there has been a black site at Poland, that there has been one apparently in Diego Garcia, which the British government has vehemently denied that existed. And over the past 10 years, maybe a little longer, a number of journalists, as you mentioned, your wife Larissa, and human rights organizations, I mean, the Associated Press, the Washington Post, they all have reported these stories. They've noted this in published reports, attributing the information to anonymous sources, government officials, intelligence officials. But now the Senate has gone through 6 million pages of records from the CIA, documents from other government agencies, a small set of documents from other government agencies, and even documents that other groups turned over to the Senate committee, and this is what they found. So it's finally this confirmation that the CIA has been operating this network of prisons, secret prisons across Europe, that dozens of high-value prisoners, those deemed to be low-value prisoners, were held in these prisons where some of the more brutal torture techniques were used, ones that never really even had any Justice Department authorization, the CIA then would dump some of them at Guantanamo, or hand them off to foreign intelligence services. And this is a pretty shocking claim that, the Senate apparently just, tried to, using the CIA's records, tried to find what happened to them. And they're unaccounted for, or at least some of them, and presumed dead.
Yeah, well, but I think I read in the Washington Post, at least before, that only two CIA captives were ever tortured to death, and that was it. And then we learned that Eric Holder, actually, that was the one case where Eric Holder had appointed a special prosecutor to investigate whether he ought to investigate the CIA agents what did those murders.
Right.
And then he decided that his preliminary investigation found that no, he should not have an investigation into those murders. So
yeah,
what about that?
The,
that's not
the,
correct?
Well, that's what, that's clearly what we were told. And that is how Eric Holder sort of set it up, where, review these cases to see if there's any evidence to bring, criminal charges. And those deaths were in Afghanistan and Iraq, if I'm not mistaken. And one of them was a, an Iraqi police officer, I believe. So that seems to be debunked by this Senate report. Now, the Senate report, by the way, It only looked at, or I shouldn't say it only looked at, but it looked at the about 119 prisoners that were in CIA custody. As far as I could tell, these are not ghost prisoners. That's a different designation. Those are prisoners who actually were kept off the books in Iraq. So, for example, in Iraq, the CIA was, you know, sort of going back and forth, and they'd have some prisoners actually at Abu Ghraib that they never, you know, were completely off the books. I don't believe, don't have that information, but I don't believe that this pertains to that. This Senate report pertains to about 119 prisoners that were more or less kept at you know, the various black sites: Poland, Romania, Lithuania, Thailand, Morocco, and Guantanamo. Again, apparently Diego Garcia and Afghanistan was the where majority of these prisoners were held. And then it goes through the, you know, there's some real shocking details, if you can believe it, if you haven't been shocked enough as it is, about the first high-value captive, and that's Abu Zubaydah. You know, it seems to, the Senate report seems to confirm that really what was being done to him was more or less like, you know, kind of an experiment research to help sort of set the stage and for the interrogations and torture of prisoners down the road, that, you know, that really would be kind of part of this legal guidance that John Yoo put together. And what I mean by that is that the Senate, again, this is coming from, you know, people who have been who have read portions of the report. And I should also note that there's a lot of leaking going on in Washington right now. And Dianne Feinstein, who hates leaks, seems to be sort of like, you know, just remaining silent because the CIA is leaking their side of the story to certain reporters. And of course, you know, we're getting another look at it. But, you know, the Senate report, from what I'm told, it seems to show that Abu Zubaydah was being tortured way before that memo was written. And in fact, the techniques and certain methods that were used on him, notably sleep deprivation, took on a sort of a form of research. And it was that research, that guidance, that was later given to John Yoo to write the memo, which he used in there. For example, saying, "Oh, you can keep Abu Zubaydah up for 11 days," and that's based on research that you've done, you know, keeping Abu Zubaydah up for 11 days. So,
listen, Jason, you're not going to make me lose face on the Zubaydah thing, are you? Come on.
In terms of what? Yeah, that he was tortured in August.
Well, no, I mean, that was the quote from Ron Suskind about George Bush complaining to George Tenet when George Tenet
informed Bush that this guy
who you keep invoking, it turns out that he's a nobody and he's half crazy and he never was Osama bin Laden's number three guy. And so you should be careful about saying that. And Bush got mad because he'd already been saying that. And so he said, "You're not going to make me lose face on this."
That's right. Yeah, I took you a little too literally there. Let me say this.
Yeah, sorry. I'm really not that funny most of the time, so.
Abu Zubaydah, though, he was not crazy. He was not, you know, suspect.
Well, what he wasn't also was Osama's number three guy. And that's what's more important. Because even if he was crazy, it's more likely that they made him crazy by torturing him at Hitler's former torture base in Poland.
Right. Yes. There's an important point. He was not, bin Laden's number three. In fact, you know, again, some of the material that the Senate looked at, and, you know, try to imagine, I mean, it's been difficult for me to imagine what six million records looks like. I mean, that is just unbelievable. You could imagine what's probably in those records. But they found evidence of you know, the CIA officials lying to Congress about promising members of Congress that they were not violating the ban on cruel and unusual punishment with regard to these prisoners, that you know, when questions came up about certain interrogation techniques, they were told one story, and now they, you know, the lawmakers found out another story. So, and again, you know, just getting back to Zubeda, they, you know, found out that, you know, the CIA was doing things to him that that they were never told about, and they claimed that they asked about it. So, perhaps, you know, most troubling at this point, though, is that, you know, is that the report is going through a declassification review, and there have been promises made to, you know, to these countries like Poland and the UK, I believe, and some others, that they basically won't be identified in the report. So while the report sort of, you know, is broken up into three volumes and takes a look at, you know, the genesis of this program, you know, how they were captured and detained, and the value of the intelligence, it still remains unclear if we're actually going to see, you know, first of all, any of the names of the prisoners themselves in there, you know, whether those, when that executive summary is declassified and released, whether that will actually be revealed, or whether it'll just be sort of a compilation of what was done.
Right. Well, you know, even then, good journalists like yourself will be able to read through the lines and say, oh, yeah, we already know whose genitals you cut with razor blades in Morocco to get him to make up a dirty bomb plot with Jose Padilla. We talked with his lawyer on the show yesterday. So you can blank out his name all you want. It's Binyam Mohammed, and you guys are guilty. And, I mean, what kind of crime is that? If you were a federal prosecutor and a civilian did that kind of thing to anyone under any circumstances, what kind of prosecution would happen? It'd be over in a day, and it would be decades in prison. Anyway, then I wanted to get back real quick, Jason, before the break here, and whatever, and I'll turn the whole mic over to you at the end, but I wonder about what you're hearing from your sources here about the dead. At least 10 of these guys turned over to the CIA. Did they say to Egypt, I was thinking about, you know, what Robert Baer said about the rendition program, even going all the way back to the Clinton years, that, well, if you want them tortured, you send them to Bashar al-Assad in Syria. If you want them to disappear forever, you send them to Mubarak in Egypt.
Yes, I didn't put it in my story because, but I feel comfortable talking about it. You know, I did hear Syria, Egypt, and Libya. Obviously,
and
those,
Libya, that's right, yeah.
And those are countries that you know, we have stood up and said, you know, we're involved in torture, and here we are, you know, turning some prisoners over to them as well.
Yeah, thanks for suiciding out Libby for us. We didn't want him interviewed by Jason Leopold. No,
right.
Thank you. All right, well, we'll be right back after this with more from Jason Leopold on the CIA kidnapping and torturing people to death. And the new Senate report that we may get to see some of, its summary. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jason Leopold, writing for America.AlJazeera.com, and he's talking to people who have seen this summary of the Senate torture investigation, the one that is now being turned over to the CIA to be scribbled on with black magic markers before they release it. So, as he said, you know, we don't really know what we're going to get here, but it sounds like
the State Department is also, by the way, weighing in on this, and that's they're getting an opportunity to make recommendations, and you can imagine that obviously will have to do with identifying, you know, certain countries.
Now, same thing I've been saying all along is that somebody's just got to leak the whole report, and then that'll just be it. Go ahead and put it on WikiLeaks and let the world see it. And
yeah,
then
if a lot of Republicans and Democrats have to go to prison, including people currently in the U.S. Congress, fine with me.
Yeah.
Fine with the law, if there's such a thing as the law, after all.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, Scott. You know, this, at the same time, while I'm reporting on this, I also have an active Freedom of Information Act lawsuit for this report. And, you know, I've been battling the government for almost a year for this report, where they contend that it's a congressional record and not an executive branch record, which would make it subject to FOIA. So now that the report has been, that there has been a vote to declassify and that it's been given up or it's being handed off to the White House, CIA, and others for a declassification, you know, the judge in my case is actually saying, well, you know, let's talk about this. So, you know, my point in saying this is that, I feel like I can possibly sort of wage a little bit of a battle if they, you know, say that, in fact, yes, this should be released under FOIA to try to have, you know, further unredactions made. But, you know, in terms on the transparency front, I also want to make a note that when you release a document like this, and if it does contain the revelations that we've been promised, that we've been told by Dianne Feinstein and Mark Udall and Ron Wyden, one can then make a case to try and have other material that has been kept under wraps, that has been classified for the past 10 years, to try to pry that loose. So this could sort of open up the door to, you know, trying to gain access to other records. And I certainly would hope that other journalists sort of, you know, take advantage of that opportunity.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you're really a pioneer in that. In fact, I'd like to mention that Kelly Vlahos at antiwar.com has a great write-up about Jason that you guys might want to take a look at. And this is sort of part of the chilling of sources since Obama's war beyond Nixon against sources and journalists in Washington, D.C., that you've just decided, you know what, I'm just going to sue your ass for the hard proof all day, and then I don't need two sources and confirmation. I got your document where you admit it yourselves, you bastards. So that's you're setting a great example for journalists about, you know, mileage that can be gotten there, you know, a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's funny. That's sort of what I say to my wife when I'm when she's asking me, like, why are you doing this? You know, yes, that's exactly it. I mean, look, you know, when I put this report out yesterday, it's, you know, should let your listeners know. I mean, these are unnamed officials. You know, I spoke to, on Monday, I spoke to a CIA officer, and he was providing me with some information as to, you know, what his feelings were about this, why he said, you know, why he felt that, you know, that torture did not work, and that, you know, people like Mike Hayden and John Rizzo and Jose Rodriguez, you know, these top CIA officials, you know, they're going out there and making all these claims, but they're just false. And I said, well, you know, why don't you go on the record? Can you go on the record? Can you talk about this? And he said, are you nuts? You know, he said, once you go on the record, once you talk about this, you're completely marginalized. The CIA marginalizes you, and you know, what he said was you're unemployable. Your life is turned upside down. And so, you know, you sort of get stuck in this position where, you know, you rely on anonymous sources. I obviously don't have this document. I have no idea what it says. I trust what they say. But, you know, getting back to that, what you were talking about with regard to FOIA, you know, it's, and getting the government's documents, yeah, that's the battle. That's the fight that as a journalist, you know, I'd like to wage, because it's, you know, it's in the public interest. The public has a right to see it. You know, at that point, it's like, you know, you can't dispute a document. So, you know, I still have directly related to this issue, to the CIA's program, black sites, et cetera, you know, other, you know, lawsuits. And I do hope that, you know, the material will come out and I'll be able to share it with everyone.
Yeah, well, I sure would like to see it. Do you have your own kind of encrypted secure drop thing where people can send documents straight to you?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have that all set up. You can see that on my, you know, on my Twitter profile. I mean, it's very easy to set that up. Yeah. Or rather, to get in touch with me that way.
Let the word go forth.
Yeah.
Leopold writes about documents.
Yeah.
Give him documents to write about. You
know, and just a, you know, on the same note, if I may, you know, on Monday, I put this report out on, again, on Al Jazeera. You know, since the Snowden leak, since the leaks by Edward Snowden last June, you know, the NSA has been inundated with Freedom of Information Act requests, 600% increase. They have seen, since the first Snowden leak, 5,200 FOIA requests compared with about 800 or so, you know, I believe the previous year. And it was great to see. I got these FOIA logs, so we were able to see what the post-Snowden FOIA requests are. And it's incredible. People are, you know, they saw these stories. They're you know, journalists, the public, you know, research groups. They're contacting, you know, the NSA, filing these FOIA requests, saying, "Hey, you know, I want this." Unfortunately, the NSA is virtually exempt from FOIA, and you know, they mostly issue GLOMARs. But you know, the point being that documents, we're in a time right now where documents, primary source material, is so valuable, and the public really, really craves that information, as you know. So it's a worthwhile effort.
Right. And you know what? It's worthwhile for the reaction, too, as Julian Assange wrote in his manifesto that, you know, the more stuff is leaked, the more they clamp down. But that also means that the government can't share information with each other about how to get away with all the horrible things that they get away with all the time. And so their power becomes that much less effective.
That's true.
And they don't have the right. You know, anytime they declassify anything, you can tell that all they were trying to do is protect themselves from any accountability. I mean, you know, I don't know what would be considered a legitimate secret, but there are not many. Most of them are just about the American empire and other people's countries, none of which is legitimate at all, each and every aspect of which is a scandal that, you know, deserves to be revealed to the people.
Yeah. Yes, and look, you know, it's not as if we're at a point where all the secrets have been revealed, or, you know, all the information is out there. I mean, if anything,
no, it's more secrecy than ever before.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you know, so it continues to you know, it demand, you know, aggressive reporting, and so, you know, just again with this Senate report, you know, they have a 6,600 page report, and they're releasing 480 pages in an executive summary.
Yeah.
And while that is a nice chunk of material, I mean, you know, Scott, 6,600 pages, you know, that's not that much out of, you know, what they put together. And so that really should be out there as well, even if it is declassified, but it should be out there. And it doesn't seem like, you know, there's going to be any effort to release that. So here they have, you know, this voluminous report, 6,600 pages, and to just sort of satisfy the public, or to you know, keep people quiet, or to say, hey, now it's over, you know, they're going to give up 480 pages. You know, at the same time, you should note that there's no, it doesn't come with any sort of recommendation for accountability, for investigation.
Yeah.
You know, back in 2009, and you and I have spoken about this before, the Senate Armed Services Committee released a parallel report. And that parallel report pertained to the treatment of detainees in custody of the U.S. military. And there was a lot of info in there about the, you know, the overlap with the CIA. And Carl Levin, who was the chairman of that committee, he recommended, in that report, he said, I am making a recommendation to Eric Holder to investigate and hold people accountable. Now, of course, that never happened, as we both know, but the point being that the Senate Intelligence Committee report contains no such recommendation.
Right. Yeah, and then the Judiciary Committee, which you almost said there, they never looked at it at all.
So, right, yeah, yeah. So
there's no recommendation from them either.
So this report comes out, and it's like, well, you know, what next? And basically, there, you know, there isn't the next. It's,
well, and that's the most important point here, is that, listen, if these guys have the authority to torture people to death, or at least the president has the authority to turn that on or off like a switch or a tap there, then there's nothing that they can't do. And if there's no accountability for this, and there's no accountability for anything in what's supposedly a democratic society here. I mean, this is torturing people to death. Right?
Yeah.
That's the end
yeah.
of it. And now we're out of time. I keep doing that to everybody's interview, talking till the end of it and not having time for any more questions. Sorry. Thanks very much for your time on the show, Jason. It's always great to talk at you.
Always appreciate it, Scott. Thank you.
That's Jason Leopold, everybody. He's great. He's at America.AlJazeera.com. Senate report contains new details on black sites. See you tomorrow.